He's a world-renowned psychologist, educator, and author. His latest book, We Who Wrestle with God, is number one on both the New York Times and Amazon's bestseller list. Tonight, Dr. Jordan Peterson talks about the power of biblical stories, today's toxic cultural environment, his wife's religious conversion, and his own personal faith. It's an interview you don't want to miss. The World Over begins right now. Right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We have a great show for you tonight. Jordan Peterson straight ahead. If you'd like to comment, send me a tweet. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Real Raymond Arroyo at Instagram. Some news for you. First, President-elect Donald Trump will be attending the reopening celebration for Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris on December 7th. It's been over 5 years since the 2019 fire that nearly destroyed the historic cathedral. Over 50 heads of state are also expected to attend. In a Truth Social post earlier this week, Trump wrote, "It is an honor to announce that I will be traveling to Paris, France on Saturday to attend the reopening of the magnificent and historic Notre Dame Cathedral." This will be President-elect Trump's first international trip since defeating Kamala Harris in November's presidential election. And in a cultural shift, recent studies are showing that younger American men are now more religious than younger American women. In a recent survey, 54% of Gen Z women are leaving religious practice as opposed to only 46% of Gen Z men. Gen Z is defined as anyone born between 1997 and 2012. Feminism, dissatisfaction over gender roles, and abortion seem to be issues driving women away from organized religion, and Christianity in particular. We'll keep an eye on this significant story. And in a related story that I just love, in the early hours of Thanksgiving morning, a California pastor trained in mixed martial arts subdued an axe-wielding burglar who broke into his church. Pastor Nick Neves, trained in martial arts, jiu-jitsu, and kickboxing, used his skills to detain the intruder for 15 minutes until police arrived and took him into custody. The suspect used an axe to smash a window at the First Family Church in Antioch, California, when he was confronted by Pastor Neves, who had gone to check on the church after hearing the security alarm go off. Neves said he wished the man had come earlier, when he could have fed and cared for him instead of choosing to desecrate the church property and harm their ministries. During his Sunday sermon, Neves asked the congregation to pray for the man out of concern for his soul. I think we need more pastors like that, capable of battling evil in all its manifestations. He's a New York Times best-selling author, an internationally renowned psychologist, a cultural critic, and an internet force of nature. He began stirring controversy and making headlines in his native Canada back in 2016. His videos opposing speech codes went viral, and Jordan Peterson has been a cultural icon ever since. In his latest book, We Who Wrestle with God, Perceptions of the Divine, Jordan Peterson unpacks biblical stories and reveals their cultural and religious importance. I sat down with him recently to discuss the new book, his wife Tammy's miraculous healing and religious conversion, and what faith means to him personally. Here's my exclusive interview with Dr. Jordan Peterson. At Harvard, your students, they were crying when your class ended.
There's a rumor.
That's the rumor, but they said it was almost like a cult following. What was it in your lectures that got that kind of reaction from Harvard students, of all people?
Well, I don't think that the cult reference is right. I mean, the fact that there was some emotion associated, I suppose, is what gives rise to that comparison. Mm-hmm. I mean, a cult of personal responsibility is a pretty weird cult. That's a very hard question. What was it precisely?
Yeah.
I talked about things that mattered to the students, like. And one of the things I'm able to do, I think, is take very high-level abstract ideas, psychological ideas and ideas associated with story, with drama, narrative, and explain the significance of them conceptually, but also to make them practically relevant. And I would also say that I offered my students and the people who've been watching and listening since then a different way of looking at the world, which is in both more pessimistic and more optimistic. And so that deepens everything. And I think part of the reason the students found it frustrating when the courses ended was because they often told me that the course that they took changed the way they looked at everything, but that they had a difficult time discussing it outside of the course and the other people that were in the course because their reference frame had changed so radically that it was difficult to communicate what they had learned to other people. That's a paradigm shift. That's what happens when there's a paradigm shift.
And when there's no support around. No one else.
No one else is thinking that way.
Right.
When once you catch some of the fundamental reference, then you can understand the totality of the system of thought that I'm putting forward. But it's very hard to understand otherwise.
One of the focuses of your study was the psychology of religion, I discovered. What did you principally find through that study? Long before you came to this new book, We Who Wrestle with God. You've been wrestling with God a long time, it seems to me. What, first of all, what drew you to the study of the psychology of religion in the first place?
It wasn't so much the study of the psychology of religion as it was the study of the psychology of evil. And that was really the focus of, well, the first book, my first book, Maps of Meaning. It turned into an analysis of the psychology of religion, but that was a side effect of the original pursuit. I mean, I became obsessed with the idea of evil, with the reality of evil, when I was about 13. And I did the first serious academic work I ever did, insofar as you can be serious when you're 13. And you can, there are differences in degrees in seriousness at all ages. I started to read about totalitarianism and about the Holocaust and Nazi Germany and became more and more deeply convinced over about a 10-year period that I didn't see any way of making sense of what had happened in those places except through a reference frame that was predicated on the idea of the reality of evil. There's a real cost to not believing in evil.
Right.
The cost is you relativize Auschwitz, or you relativize the Holodomor in the Ukraine. It's just another occurrence among many occurrences of the sort, and that does that those terrible catastrophes, those terrible malevolent catastrophes, a disservice. And you see, once you admit to the reality of evil, you're backed into a corner theologically, because if evil exists, then its opposite exists,
right?
And then if good exists, well, then the question, what constitutes the highest form of good, is an obvious follow-up, and that leads you down the garden path, so to speak.
And you've continued down that path. You remind me of my friend Bill Blatty. Well, William Peter Blatty wrote The Exorcist, but he wrote it, he saw that as an evangelical work, but he wrote it from the opposite perspective, because he said, if I can scare the hell out of people and get them to buy the reality of evil, its opposite, goodness, grace, God, must also be true.
The thing is, evil is more stark in its unitary presentation than good. Good is subtle in a way. It's not an easy thing to point your finger and say there is a manifestation of the highest good. It's comparatively easier, especially from a historical perspective, to point your finger and say, whatever that is, that
it's
seems evil. Yeah, definitely. And it's quite, you can't conduct an investigation like that. And I investigated multiple dimensions.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the evil that was associated with totalitarianism and, say, mass political belief, but I'm a psychopathologist, a personality psychologist, and a clinical psychologist, and so I was very interested in the lower reaches of criminal evil, too, like serial killers and sexual slayers and school shooters and all the, you know, all the things that make you wonder what's going bump in the night exactly and what's behind all that.
How did Jung regard religion? I mean, you are a Jungian psychologist. How did he regard religion as an expression of the subconscious as a dream state. How did he regard that? And how does that depart from your understanding of religion today, perhaps?
Well, you could think, one of the things that Jung did was describe, he was one of the first people to describe the relationship between biological instinct and the religious impulse. That's a good way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jung and his school, because there were a lot of brilliant people in the Jungian school. Mircea Eliade is a good example of that, Romanian historian of religions who's mm-hmm. extraordinarily brilliant. Eric Neumann, who was one of Jung's students and wrote two really remarkable books, one called The Great Mother, which is a study of the symbolism of the feminine, mm-hmm. and another called The Origins and History of Consciousness, which is a study of a really well put together study of the origins of the hero myth, much deeper, say, than Joseph Campbell, who was a good popularizer. Mm-hmm. Jung's case was that the domain of image that constitutes our one form of our thinking, the thinking that's characterized with the imagination, the thinking that we do in not only in pictures but in dramatic pictures, right, like dreams, had an intrinsic structure and a language. Now, and this is... I think this is an obvious claim, because the probability that something as complex as the world of dream, the probability that that has no structure, that's foolish. Obviously, it has a structure, because pictures aren't random. They're pictures of things, and dreams have a certain narrative coherence. Now, there are physiologists often who proclaim that dreams are random neural firing, but that's a preposterous idea.
You don't buy that.
Well, they're not random. How structured they are and at what level is a matter of dispute. But the notion, random is what you used to see on old TVs when the screen was nothing but snow. That's random. Mm-hmm. And so Jung's observation, which I think was absolutely 100% accurate, was that the landscape of the dream, first of all, is grounded in biology, in motivation and emotion,
right,
but that also has a structure, a narrative structure, linguistic structure, a quasi-linguistic structure, and it's out of that that the world of the religious arises. And that's, as far as I can tell, that's just correct. He got that right.
You really came to prominence in 2016. You'd been doing outstanding lectures. You'd been engaging in public, a public intellectual. But in 2016, you have a battle on your hands against a Canadian law that wanted to outlaw certain speech against transgender people or not using pronouns. What was it about that law that so incited you? You made a series of videos, and suddenly you were everywhere.
It was the presumptuousness of the law, first of all. There had never been a law in any Western democracy that mandated private speech, ever, not once. And in fact, the Supreme Court in the United States had explicitly forbade that sort of mandating back in the 1930s.
Right.
And so for the Trudeau government, and it figures that it was that government, to do such a thing was unprecedented. And then all of the language of the bill was a lie, and I could see that very clearly. I also knew where it was going to lead. I told the Senate, the Canadian Senate in 2016 or early 2017, that their idiot use of language, their malevolent and foolish use of language, was going to cause a psychological epidemic among young women, which is exactly what happened. And I knew that because I knew the literature on psychological epidemics, which stems back about 300 years, as it turns out. And so the thing is when you take any group of people, there's a large number of those people who are the most confused, right? They're barely hanging on.
Yeah.
And there's usually a fair number of people like that. And if you add any confusion to their conceptual structure, you throw them into utter chaos. And that is a very easy thing to do, as it turns out, with pubescent girls for all sorts of reasons. Mm. And they're the ones most susceptible to that kind of epidemic. And so I told the Senate that. But I also knew, tying this back to what we had already discussed, is, see, people think of totalitarian states as freedom-loving individuals oppressed by singular tyrannical figures, and that's complete bloody nonsense. There's nothing about that conception that's true. Totalitarian societies emerge when people lose control of their tongue. And so I know, and I already knew in 2016, long before that, that there isn't anything worse that can happen to you than to lose control of your tongue. There's no difference between that and your thoughts or your spirit or perhaps your soul. And so I was going to let a pack of jackanapes like the Trudeau mob, especially with their pandering moralism, decide that it was okay to look as if they were being moral by mandating speech. It's like, no, I don't think so. Go to hell. Well, that's where you're headed anyways, by all appearances. Well, definitely. I mean, definitely, but not even metaphysically.
But you have a problem now as a psychologist and your whole profession. The American, I'm going to read this to you. American Psychological Association recommends now, this is from their manual, trans-affirmative care that is supportive of the identities and life experiences of transgender people. I'm quoting them. Gender is a non-binary construct that allows for a range of gender identities, and a person's gender identity might not align with their sex assignment at birth. Your reaction to that, and that now, if you want your license, you have to agree to that thought, don't you?
Yes, you certainly do. Yes, yes. That's which is why all of my colleagues, or virtually all of them, turned out to be a pack of contemptible cowards. So, and I can understand their reticence in terms of, what would you say, opposing this barbaric idiocy, but that doesn't excuse it. They have a professional obligation to say and do exactly what they know to be true, and the clinical literature on such things has been clear for decades, hasn't changed a bit in the last 6 years. We know perfectly well that there is a small minority of children, generally at the instigation of their idiot parents, particularly their mothers, who are, what would you say, uncomfortable with their bodies, not that that's particularly rare, and who decide that they'd rather be identified with the other sex. The most common sort of trans individuals, an autogynephilic 40-year-old man who gets a sexual kick out of dressing up in his wife's underwear. And I'm not really in favor of people like that, especially when they regard that as a God-given right and want to change the laws to make it mandatory to approve of their fetish. And all the psychologists know this. Make no mistake about it. If they were trained in any manner that constitutes, what would you call it, genuine professional training, they know, first of all, that almost all the children who are so-called gender dysphoric desist on their own recognizance by the time they're 18. The desistance rate is at least 90%, and the proper course of treatment is leave them the hell alone. It certainly isn't prescribe them puberty blockers and hormonally transfer them on the way to the worst kind of barbaric surgery that's been conducted on anyone since the Nazi atrocities in the mid-1940s. The American Psychological Association, to call them contemptible is to say barely anything. Sickening. And the American Medical Association is just as bad. They took all this advice from these groups of activists, W-path activists, posing as scientists. A tiny bit of homework would have indicated that that's precisely what it was. And so the entire profession has been compromised, psychologists and physicians.
I consider all of this an interesting backdrop to your book, We Who Wrestle with God, because it really is about your place in the world, God's place in the world, God's place in nature, your place in nature, and how to discover that through these ancient texts. But I want to start with something I read. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Someone said this was not the original title of the book.
Yeah, that's wrong.
The original title was...
No, that's wrong. I have no idea where that came from.
Okay.
We Who Wrestle with Gods?
Yeah.
No.
No, it was never that.
No, because...
It would run counterculture. It's
an interesting idea because there are polytheistic impulses in our culture, and one of the existential realities that we do wrestle with is the fact that there are many powerful forces pulling us in many directions. But we who wrestle with God, that's the meaning of the word Israel, and that's where the title came from.
Uh-huh. So, why did you restrict yourself to the Old Testament? Just the
Old
Testament?
Oh, I didn't. The book I wrote is three times that long. So
there's more coming.
Was too long. Yeah. There's another book coming that includes the story of Job and the story of the Passion.
This is very Jungian as I read it. You've got the Brothers Grimm, Pinocchio, Lion King, Harry Potter, all being invoked side by side with Moses and Elijah. Tell me about that technique. Now, we see that in your first book, in Maps of Meaning as well, where you spent a lot of time with Pinocchio particularly. Give me a sense of why you thought that was important now.
Well, This is also something that critics of the book have objected to, particularly those on the illiterate left, I suppose. If you're interested in psychological phenomena, you have to notice when you see one. And certainly the phenomena that arose around the Harry Potter series is worthy of commentary from a psychological perspective. I mean, that body of work made a poverty-stricken author richer than the Queen. It was a major... Her work was a major proportion of Great Britain's gross domestic product. Right. So, like, if you're a psychologist or a thinker, maybe you should pay attention to that. Or you could say, well, it's just entertainment. It's like, you're a fool. Why is it entertaining?
Because it speaks and it resonates with the stories that have always
been.
Well,
that's the question.
And that's the story you're telling.
Well, if a story didn't resonate, why would anyone be interested in it? And so it's not a matter of obsession with pop culture to note that certain stories take possession of a culture. Well, the Harry Potter story is it's a Christian drama, obviously. I mean, you don't have to be particularly deep to appreciate that. I mean, if Voldemort isn't Satan, well, who is he? He's serpentine even. I mean, what sort of hint do you need? And part of the reason that the Harry Potter stories became so popular is because they fill a void. They fill part of the void that's left by the partial demise of Christianity.
Yeah.
And the superhero movies do the same thing.
Yeah, I've heard you say this, and I love this observation. When you drop religion...
You can't drop it.
Other things fill the void. Politics, cosplay, comic books. These other things rush in to kind of fill that... what we're wired to be and do and are.
Well, and often things rush in that you don't want to have rush in. I mean, here's an example that we might draw from the book. So the historian of religion, Mircea Eliade, noted when contemplating Nietzsche's doctrine that God was dead, right? God was dead and we had killed him. And Nietzsche went on to observe that we would never find enough water to wash away the blood. It wasn't a statement of triumphalism on Nietzsche's part by any stretch of the imagination. It wasn't the triumph of the rationalist mind of Friedrich Nietzsche. He knew it was a catastrophe, and he knew that what would arise in the aftermath of the death of God, so to speak, were subsidiary deities, many of whom you wouldn't want to take possession of you. Nihilism being one, so that would be really... The fractionation of belief to the point where everything but pain becomes meaningless, hedonism as a potential alternative, a totalitarian utopianism, which Nietzsche pointed to very accurately, as did Dostoevsky. There's in the story of Exodus, when Moses vanishes just in preparation to receiving the Ten Commandments, he leaves Aaron, who's the political wing, in charge of the Israelites, right? And they have the habits of slaves. They're not responsible people. And in consequence, they turn to a kind of hedonistic populism, which is exactly what happens when they worship the golden calf. And so, and they immediately engage in the kind of drunken orgies that make them laughing stocks to their enemies. And maybe anyone who has any sense might be able to see parallels with our modern culture in that regard. The observation was thousands of years ago that when the highest... So Moses has departed, which means that the connection between the Israelites and what's properly at the pinnacle has disappeared.
Right.
So now the political serves the hedonistic. That's the moral of the story. And of course it does, because if there's no sophisticated uniting principle organizing your society, why wouldn't you devolve into everybody gets what they want right now, regardless of the consequences, which is exactly what happens with the golden calf. So we've known this for a very long time.
I love how you draw out contemporary lessons from these ancient stories. And in the telling, I would argue, by bringing on those pop culture references, you're giving modern audiences a road into these stories, and bells go off where they see, oh, I know where J.K. Rowling got that from, or where Pinocchio came. That's what this is. It's serving this original story, this foundational story. Tell me about Elijah. You spend a lot of time in this book on Elijah and how Elijah, the prophet, the first major prophet, how he is key to our understanding not only of our relationship on earth, but our relationship to God and God to man.
Well, so one of the characteristics of the biblical library, because it is a library, it's a collection of stories, is that it's a collection of stories, each of which provides a different characterization of God, or you could say a different definition, because one of the questions that a wise person might have about the religious, especially in relationship to God, is just exactly what or who are we talking about? And the biblical answer to that is complex, because God, as the complex opposite of evil, let's say, is a character who can only be characterized by illustration or example, and example of multiple types. So, for example, in the story of Noah, God is the voice that calls to the wise to prepare when trouble is brewing. And then you might ask yourself, well, do you believe in that? And the answer is, well, if you're wise and you have an intuition that trouble is brewing, do you hearken to that intuition and prepare? And if the answer is yes, then you believe in it. Now, the Bible insists that that voice is the same as the voice that comes to Abraham, say, although the voice that comes to Abraham is the voice that calls to adventure.
Right.
And so
I love how you set him up as the Abraham and the call to adventure.
Yeah.
That this is a huge adventure, and it's a family adventure. It's a sacrificial adventure. Tell us about that.
Well, let's go back to Elijah. When Christ is transfigured on the mountain, two prophets appear with him, right? Moses, well, that's understandable.
And Elijah.
Well, that's a lot more difficult because Elijah, compared to Moses, at least in terms of length of text devoted to him, is a much more minor character.
Right.
And the story is more archaic and more subtle. But there's something very remarkable about the story of Elijah, even from the perspective, you might say, of evolutionary biology, evolutionary cognitive biology, because Elijah is the prophet who sets himself up against the nature worshipers, right? So he battles with the prophets of Baal, and they're Baal is a nature god. Now, we've reverted to nature worship in the modern world. The whole modern environmentalist movement is nature worship. And we could go into why that's pathological. It's pathological not least because children generally end up sacrificed to nature gods, which is exactly what we're doing right now, by the way. But Elijah sets himself up against Baal, against the prophets of Baal, and he emerges as victorious. And he's persecuted because of that by Jezebel, who's the evil queen who is on the side of the nature worshippers, right? Aligning the feminine in its pathological mode of being with nature worship, which is also something that's happening now. One of the realizations that Elijah has, given that he's not a worshiper of nature, is the nature of the god that isn't a nature god. So Elijah, when he's hiding out in a cave after being chased away by Jezebel, fearing for his life, and he observes a thunderstorm and an earthquake and essentially a hurricane or a tornado, these massive manifestations of nature, right, which are awe-inspiring,
yeah,
and which you could imagine have their roots in like a divine natural energy. And Elijah realizes that God is not in the storm or the earthquake or the conflagration, but he's the still small voice within, the voice of conscience. And so it's a remarkable conceptual transformation. First of all, because the voice of conscience isn't something that commands. It's something that suggests, right? And the voice of conscience is also something like an autonomous spirit that acts within. So your conscience tells you things about how you act that you don't want to hear. And so you might ask yourself, well, where does that come from?
Right.
What's its origin? And why is it that although you don't have to listen to it, you don't have to hearken to it or abide by it, you also can't control it? It has its own autonomous nature. And the insistence in the text that describes Elijah is that the voice of conscience is equivalent to the voice of adventure that comes to Abraham and also equivalent to the voice that comes to Noah to advise the wise to batten down the hatches when trouble comes. And so it's a remarkable transformation in two ways. First of all, it detaches people from worship of the obvious, let's say nature. And second, it makes the relationship with divinity something that's personal and much more psychological. It's like God is the small voice that comes to you from within that indicates, not least by shaming you in front of yourself, that you're deviating from the divinely ordained pathway. And I actually don't see... Now, Cardinal Newman, who's a famous Catholic theologian, he believed the most powerful argument for the existence of God from a phenomenological perspective, so as you could experience it, was in fact the reality of the voice of conscience. And I think that's a great argument. It's much better than many modern apologists point to the complexity of the created world as evidence for God. It's a weak argument for all sorts of reasons, but the argument of God, of the existence of God in relation to conscience. See, this is a definitional issue, right? Yeah. Because the text of Elijah defines God as the voice of conscience.
It's still small voice.
It's still small voice, exactly. And well, there's many definitions of God in the biblical library. They do conclude that there's an underlying unity, which is finally expressed in the figure of Christ, which I also think seems appropriate. Yeah. You asked what Jung believed.
Yes.
Certainly Jung believed that he believed, like St. Augustine, that the soul was naturally Christian, so to speak. That unites the material or the divine, the heavenly with the biological.
That we're pre-wired that way. That we come that way. We're created that way.
That those sorts of beliefs, like the belief in the necessity of the ultimate voluntary self-sacrifice, let's say, is part and parcel of implicit, innate human nature. Mm-hmm. And you can read that biologically, or you could read it as created. I don't think it makes any difference.
There's a wonderful moment in the book I want to read where you talk about Genesis, the first words of Genesis, and you write that those opening verses of Genesis are a world-ordering idea, a civilization-engendering idea. What does that mean?
Well, it's very frequently the case. This is something that Mircea Eliade noted, that at the beginning of civilization, civilizations are generally founded on the kind of revelatory vision that contains a tremendous amount of motivational and emotional impetus. It's the same thing a leader does when he founds a new organization. The leader establishes a vision. Mm-hmm. The vision fills people with enthusiasm, and they act out the structure of the vision. Well, these revelatory visions, every civilization is founded on a revelatory vision, and the Genesis story has a revelatory vision in it. It proclaims human consciousness. It proclaims the consciousness that gives rise to everything as is the spirit that wrestles with possibility. That's a good way of thinking about it, because the tohu vabohu that God forms at the beginning of time, properly understood, the translation properly understood, is something like chaotic potential.
Right. Right. He breathed over the chaos
And forms it
forms
into the order
into
that's
order.
Good. Well, and specifically into a world that's good or very good. Mm-hmm. It's very specific. Mm-hmm. It's not just the world. It's the world insofar as it's good or very good. And then, so that's the first proposition, is that there's a spirit at work at the beginning of time, now and forever, that contends with chaotic possibility and engenders the order that's good. And then the secondary proposition is that what it means to be man and woman alike is to bear the image of that process. And that's, I think, both of those things are correct.
Reading this book and watching you now and seeing you talk about this on the road, you are on fire about this topic. You burn for this topic. So for some reason, you are burning to tell this story, and you've
resonated. Well, I told you the reason.
Which
I told
was?
You the reason. Well, you see, this is, I suppose this has something to do with my relationship with my father. See, my father had great confidence in me. He really imbued me with a particular kind of confidence when I was a kid, a small kid, like little, 2 to 4 or 5.
And you lost your dad this year.
Yes, I did.
A professor, and I know very close to you.
Yeah. Well, Dad had my back, and now that's not exactly right. Dad was very much behind me insofar as I was trying to do the right thing. So that's a much better way of thinking about it. He imbued in me the belief that if I could understand something, then I could, if I could understand how something worked, then I could repair it if it was broken. That's a good way of thinking about it. And so I spent most of my life trying to understand the origins of evil. And I have been writing and talking about what I discovered, trying to sort that out. And I think that I have sorted it out, at least to some degree, and that's partly why people find what I'm doing compelling. And there isn't anything more important to do than that. See, I also fell under the sway of Jung's thinking decades ago now, but Jung believed that in the aftermath of World War II and the dawn of the atomic age, that the biggest danger that that presented itself to humanity was the evil within, because that was now allied with a technology that was literally world-destroying in its capability. And so Jung's proposition was that there was nothing more physically real than the psychological battle that played itself out in the human realm. And that's right. It's correct. It's obviously true, given the magnitude of our technology.
So you've spent your life analyzing the nature of evil, identifying it, trying to correct it in the world. Have you found the corrective here? Is this the solution? Because it seems to me, after reading this book, the living God is at the center of Jordan Peterson's maps of meaning. This is the ultimate map of meaning.
Well, this is, it's a continual extension of the work that I started when I wrote Maps of Meaning. This one concentrates more specifically on the biblical stories. I mean, I would say that the germ of this, of the thesis of this book, is already there in Maps of Meaning. It's certainly there in Jung's work as well. Yes. And in some ways, I didn't complete the book, as I said, because there's another volume that's associated with it. But there's an idea that Christians know well, that the biblical stories, as they're aggregated, edited, and sequenced, are pointing to something. And what they're pointing to, of course, is the passion of Christ. And part of the psychological understanding of that passion is that the world is properly set in order, and that would be the order that's good or very good,
right,
as a consequence of the willingness of consciousness to take on the full weight, to voluntarily take on the full weight of being. And that would be mortality, suffering, and also malevolence. And so that's all part of the passion story, right? Because there's betrayal and death, and also the harrowing of hell, the confrontation with malevolence. And all you have to do to understand why that has to be true is to consider the alternative proposition, which is that the world is set in the order that is good as a consequence of people's voluntary willingness to shrink away from the challenges of existence. Well, that's a preposterous claim.
Yeah.
And it's obviously the case that we set our own houses in order by confronting the challenges that beset us, and that there's no limit to the extent of that. This is why in Western cultures, there's an insistence, biblically based cultures, there's an insistence that each person is in their soul a true sovereign, which is why the law and the state are bounded. It's the foundation of natural law, you might say. And the reason for that is that if you're self-governing, you don't need a king. Or if you're self-governing, you are the king. Or if you're self-governing, then you follow the one true king. And all of that's true, and obviously true. It has to be the case. It's a logical necessity as well as an existential reality.
To me, there's a tantalizing coda at the end of this book. Your very last words, I think it's on page 505 of the book. You write in Latin. Well, first you ask the Nietzsche question, is God dead? You say no. And then you write in Latin, God is reborn. What does that mean to you, and why did you end the book that way?
Well, the whole book and its companion are an explanation of exactly that. Look, Iliad, as I said, pointed out that God has died many times in human history. Like, it's the presumption of the Enlightenment West that people were superstitiously religious until the Enlightenment struck, and then we realized the foolishness of our superstitious preoccupations and the fantasy world that we lived in, and we dispensed with the idea of the transcendent, and now we're all empiricists and scientists, is that God has died many times in human history and been reborn, many, many times. And you see that in the Exodus story. When Moses disappears, the voice of the prophet, and the people fall into hedonistic golden calf worship. It's exactly the same thing. There's no removing, there's no eradicating the central unity that characterizes the human spirit without eradicating the human itself. It's bound to rise again. I pointed out, for example, in the book that you see that motif in, well, in the Pinocchio movie, for example, which and people, again, are, what would you say? They're contemptuous.
They're dismissive of that.
Yeah, but they're fools.
Like, no, it opens doors of understanding, I think.
What people are doing when they watch something like an animated movie, especially a masterpiece like Pinocchio, is they're doing something magical. Everyone knows that it's drawings. There's nothing about it that's real, and yet it's gripping, and it's gripping enough to evoke emotion. And there are elements of it that people swallow and accept without understanding even that it's a complete bloody mystery that they would do that. So, for example, in one, it's the climax scene of the entire movie, essentially, when Pinocchio finds his father languishing in the belly of a whale. And that's a death of God motif. And so the father is languishing in the underworld because the son, the divine son, is absent. That's precisely what's happening.
That's
people understand that, which is why they accept that as a plot line. And then Pinocchio masters fire. That's the first thing he does. And he rescues his father from the belly of the whale. And that not only redeems his father, defeats the monster of chaos, which is a recapitulation of the early chapter or the earliest sentences of Genesis, but that's also what redeems him and stops him from being the puppet of forces he doesn't understand, which include, by the way, in the movie, hedonism, that's Pleasure Island, pride, deceit, that's the proclivity to be an actor,
right.
and neurotic suffering, which is it's a trip to Pleasure Island that's the medication for neurotic suffering in the movie. They nailed it, and they nailed it perfectly.
But you know what? You know what your critics will say. Your critics will say Jordan Peterson is reducing or putting the Bible, these ancient beloved stories that many Christians believe are true, that you're putting them on the same plane as a fairy tale. And that upsets them. Because this is the word of God and that isn't. Even though it's reflective.
Well, God's a tricky character, you know, and he tends to show up in places you don't necessarily expect. And also on occasions when you'd rather he wasn't there. So, it's like I said, it's easy to be dismissive, but that doesn't speak of anything approximating wisdom.
On page 501, you write, God calls us to be who we truly are, like Abraham and Sarah, who they truly are. Who do you truly want to be, and who are you being called to be, do you think, through this work?
Well, that's something you figure out as you go along, right? I mean, in the Abrahamic story, you see, the Abrahamic story is an account of sequential transformations of personality, upward-aiming transformations of personality. So what Abraham is essentially doing is climbing Jacob's ladder.
Right,
and he makes a sacrifice at each major point of transformation. And you sacrifice at a point of major personality transformation because when a new field of opportunity opens itself up to you, you have to dispense with things that are no longer appropriate to your new circumstances. That's a sacrificial gesture. The magnitude of the sacrifices that Abraham is called upon along the way increase, right? They culminate in the demand that he sacrifice his son, which is something that doesn't occur,
right?
He's willing to act it out, but it doesn't occur. Well, we don't know what Abraham's destiny is. God tells him that if he follows the spirit of adventure, that he'll be a blessing to himself, to other people, that he'll establish something of permanence, and that he'll do that in a way that's beneficial to everyone. How that's going to occur, well, the devil's in the details, and that's the case for every life, is that there's no limit to upward movement, and there's no predicting the outcome, which that's why it's an adventure.
Do
so
you feel,
I don't have any idea what's... I have no idea what's going to happen.
Do you feel you're on that upward movement and part of that adventure?
Well, I'm definitely on an adventure because I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen to me even minute for minute. And so, and I don't look out more than about 6 months, partly because there's no point in doing so. Things are so unpredictable now, and things are changing so rapidly that that's sufficient horizon. But
speaking of that, your wife, Tammy, was diagnosed with this horrible cancer, very rare cancer, was given 10 months to live. Mm-hmm. A friend brings her the rosary. They start praying the rosary. She has a major conversion through this experience. She's healed, essentially.
Yeah, and looks she, like it.
It looks like it. And she tells your son at one point, you know, the doctor, he's a man and he has his opinion. Maybe he's right. Maybe he's not right. The only way to know is God, because God will decide when I die. Did that and her example of trust change your vision of faith at all or deepen it?
I don't know if it was exactly trust. It's a funny way of thinking about it. It's not like Tammy. See, it depends on
well, she's trusting God, Jordan.
Well, but either way, you see, that's the thing, is if you're listening to that account casually, you'd think that Tammy would have trusted God to heal her, let's say. That isn't what happened. What happened to her was that she was willing to aim up regardless of the outcome, mm-hmm. and willing to let that go wherever it was going to go, and that could mean that her life continued. It could mean that it didn't. It didn't matter. And
right.
So one of the things that was remarkable about the way that she conducted herself while she was ill, and mortally ill as far as we were all concerned, was that she conducted herself in an exemplary manner. And that was the miracle. I mean, she did survive her cancer, which is something very difficult to account for. But the miracle, I would say more precisely, was in the equanimity that was manifested in the equanimity with which she confronted her fate. And that was, and I see, I do believe that this is the case, because one of the promises in the biblical texts is that God walks with you in precise proportion to your existential courage. Mm. And I think that's true clinically. I mean, one of the things that clinical psychologists have discovered in the last 100 years in every subdiscipline, including the psychiatric, is that if people are willing to confront the things that they're afraid of, that they despise, that they're contemptuous of, even that they're disgusted by, if they're willing to confront them voluntarily, they don't get less afraid, they get braver. Yeah, that more of their character reveals itself, and there doesn't seem to be a limit to that. And so there isn't any difference between that claim than the claim that if you confront what terrifies you voluntarily, then the spirit of the God of your forefathers walks with you. I think that's exactly right. Now, what that means, well, all of the meanings of the biblical texts fade out into our ignorance. We can never say what they're about in the final analysis. We know that, for example, in consequence of the account of Moses' encounter with God. At one point in the story of Moses, God rewards Moses with a divine vision, but he hides Moses between two cliffs, essentially, so he can only see out a crack, and then he only gets a glimpse of God's back as he walks by, and that points to a variety of things. It points to the fact that in the final analysis, God is beyond all understanding, and perhaps even beyond all tolerance. You can't live through a full exposure to the infinite, let's say. It would break, it would shatter you in pieces. But it also points to the fact that, what would you say, that you're establishing a relationship through these stories with something that's ultimately beyond you. It walks with you, and you can characterize it, but in the final analysis, it remains outside of your grasp.
But in Tammy's case, it wasn't a thought or an idea or even a story. It was an act. It was an act of faith.
That it was a revelation first, before that.
How so?
Well, see, Tammy's attitude towards her own survival changed when she told our son about her impending demise. Because I would say she probably treated her own existence in a manner that was too cavalier up to that point. Now, I'm not saying that in a critical way, like in a dismissively critical way. I'm saying that she didn't value herself properly, and until she told her son that she might not be around, and she saw reflected in him the value of her existence in his distress. Now, the reason that was so relevant to Tammy was because she really loved her son. She was an excellent mother, Tammy, and very responsive to her kids and very much oriented towards the care of both of them. And so she poured out love to her son, let's say, in an unstinting manner, more than she did to herself. And then when she revealed her potential demise to him, she saw that reflected back, and that was what catalyzed her transformation.
The key moment to me is, we're going to let God decide. It's, to me, an act of total submission and faith to God, which that bell went off. I heard Tammy's word when I read this. You said in a podcast, a recent podcast, there's a terror of yielding to God's will and only doing what you're commanded to do or what you're invited to do by the Spirit of Truth. Why? Well, if God took such great care of your wife, Jordan, saving her, pulling her back from the jaws of death, doesn't that change you at all or transform you at all or give you confidence or comfort that God will take care of everything and is?
Well, did it change me? I think I already presumed that. I mean, watching what's happened to her hasn't been so much something that's transformed me as it has been something that's been a joy to behold, let's say. Because, you see, I knew Tammy when she was a little kid, and we were very good friends, and she was a very popular little kid. She was an excellent little kid. She was a delight to be around. And, you know, we lose that delightful, enthusiastic attractiveness of childhood as we age, which is why Christ tells his followers that unless they become as little children, they won't enter the kingdom of heaven, which is a very opaque pronouncement. But what I've seen in Tammy is that has occurred, and so that's been great. She's much more confident in who she is, and I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. In fact, quite the contrary. I guess she's done to some degree what Job did during his trials, which was to reaffirm his faith in the essential goodness of not only his being, but in being itself. And that's freed her from many of the unnecessary entrapments that had agglomerated around her. And so that's been a great thing to see. It's an endless source of revelatory delight. I think that's the major part of the transformation because, see, we've talked a lot about what happened to her too, and she had also been on tour with me by the time she had that experience for 200 or 300 lectures and had listened to all of them, and that also had its effect, and so many things came together in this experience that she had and in its aftermath. And I mean, she also worked on what had been revealed to her for like 3 years, sorting it out in her imagination, a tremendous amount of detailed work. Watching her didn't change my faith in God so much as well, I already had a deep love for my wife, but it's been a wonderful thing to see that the truth has set her free. Right. That's a great thing. If you love someone, you see, when you love someone...
The vow you made when you were married, to tell the truth. Always tell the truth.
Yeah, well, she had been doing that, but there are depths of truth, right? There are layers of truth, just like there are layers of falsehood. And it's very difficult to get to the truth itself. That's for sure. It's a journey into Dante's Inferno. Absolutely, 100%. And so that's a very difficult thing to undertake. But she's done that very forthrightly, and it's been nothing but good for her, and it's a wonderful thing to see. And so, now, has that increased my faith in God?
Yes.
Well, like I said, it was already there to a large degree. I mean, I had decided a long, long time ago, like in 1985, that I was going to see where pursuit of the truth might take me. I've been doing that for a long time.
Even if it led you to God?
Well, I think that the decision to let truth take you where it will is the decision to put yourself in the hands of the Spirit that bloweth where it listeth. Right? That's the same thing. You know, modern people are obsessed with the propositionalization of the religious. They believe that what you say you believe is true is what you believe is true. And I'm afraid that that's part of it, but it's by no means all of it. And it isn't obvious to me that it's the main part even. Mm-hmm. And so it isn't that Abraham proclaims his belief in God that's the key element of the story. It's that Abraham is willing to become the captain of an armed legion and face the terrible realities of battle and of the corrupt city that's emblematic of his faith. Mm. And this is something that I would say that Western religious tradition, because of our emphasis on the propositional, that's an Enlightenment emphasis, is we've lost sight of the fact that the religious is something you act out,
right,
not something you state.
Is this Jordan Peterson's act of faith?
Well, it's an, let's see, is it an act of faith? Well, everything you actually do is an act of faith.
But is this book an act of faith for you?
Everything I do is an act of faith. Now, whether I'm doing it perfectly or not, that's a whole different question. But you can't write a book without... Everything you do that you do in spite of the evidence, let's say, or in absence of the evidence, is an act of faith. Certainly
every
to undertake
act.
A book. Well, when you get married, it's an act of faith, because what the hell do you know? When you take on a new job, well, you don't know anything about what it's going to be like to be married.
It's true.
You don't know what's going to happen when you take on a new job, or when you move to a new city, or when you make a new friend, or when you start a new business. All of those things are done in the spirit of faith in the unknown, unless you're being manipulative and deceitful, in which case you just have faith in manipulation and deceit. So you're stuck with faith. Yeah. Everything, every being that's ignorant is stuck with faith, clearly, because you don't have the evidence at hand.
Well, I am delighted you gave me, you had the faith in us to do this interview. It's
well,
been
thank
a
you very much
I
for coming.
I wish we could do another hour. It's awesome. And the book, We Who Wrestle with God, we'll keep wrestling.
Yes, well, good luck with that.
Well, this is a good start. Mm-hmm.
We Who Wrestle with God, Perceptions of the Divine by Dr. Jordan Peterson is available now at bookstores everywhere and online. What a conversation. An incredible, brilliant mind. And with Advent already upon us, my Christmas album, Christmas Merry and Bright, is available wherever music is sold and at the EWTN catalog. It's a wonderful way to bring cheer and rhythmic hope to your Christmas celebrations. And my books, The Spider Who Saved Christmas and The Wise Men Who Found Christmas, are also available at the EWTN catalog and wherever you get your books. They're wonderful stories to read aloud as a family, and I know they'll enrich your holidays in incredible ways. That's all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.